Good morning.
Good morning.
So today I'm going to, let's see, what am I going to do today? Today I'm going to talk from the day-long workshop that I gave at St. Thomas 3 weeks ago on mindfulness at work. That was day-long, and it included a lot of exercises. So we won't do any exercises, and I'll just talk for about 45 minutes about some of the key things that I've talked about and that people asked about. Daniel Goleman is the guy who came up with the term emotional intelligence. What was that, about 30 years ago? 30, 35 years ago? Well, what people didn't realize was, but they came to realize it soon, that Daniel Goleman was also a Jubu. And he self-identified himself as a Jubu. And he was doing mindfulness. And he felt that the key to emotional intelligence actually was the development of mindfulness. And he said in his first book, the better we know ourselves, the more we will empathize with others, and the more we will be able to get the best from ourselves and them. And in his book on emotional intelligence, he didn't define mindfulness, but it's been defined lots and lots of times. So here's my little definition. Non-judgmental, honest awareness of thoughts, emotions, sensations in the present. And of course, we always have a degree of mindfulness, or we wouldn't be sitting here in this room together. We had to be mindful to get here. We had to put our hands on the steering wheel. We had to turn on the car. We had to be somewhat mindful. If our chattering just overwhelmed us entirely, we'd still be in bed, or something, right? But to develop mindfulness takes repetition and drill, repetition and drill, repetition and drill. And mindfulness can occur anywhere. So the meditation that we do here, our walking and sitting meditation, is a category, or we could say a subcategory of mindfulness. And it's basically what I learned, and when the people started talking about mindfulness, we didn't really talk about it in Zen, I thought, kind of, what's that? But actually, meditation is kind of the main historical form of mindfulness. So when I was teaching at the St. Thomas workshop, I taught meditation. I taught both focused meditation, shamatha in Sanskrit. No, excuse me, in Pali, and vipassana. So both focused meditation and bare awareness meditation. Or for those of you who are really into Soto Zen, both concentrating on your breathing and shikantaza, where you do nothing at all, but just sit and look at the wall and just be aware. You're just aware of whatever goes on. You're not trying to get anywhere or do anything. And at the workshop, I taught three breaths, taking three breaths before they sit down, when they get up, after they've gone to the bathroom, before a stressful meeting, whenever. Just three breaths. Very simple. These practices are so simple. We want something that will really change us, so these simple practices we tend to overlook, but they're so wonderful, and we really do them. I taught journaling, I taught eating meditation, I taught conversation. The one thing I didn't teach that we emphasize in Zen is manual labor, mindfulness. We're big on manual labor, part of our tradition. So by practicing mindfulness, we sooner or later avoid seeing crises as insurmountable problems. We develop a positive view of ourselves and some confidence and ability to do stuff, to solve problems, to do stuff. That comes not from that comes not from little Tim, who or little whoever you are, whatever your name is, but that comes from letting go of little Tim and just being mindfully present. That's all. Very simple. Very simple. When I was first married, I was very shy. And actually, when I was in college, I was very shy. And so shy that I didn't want to, you know, go up and talk to a stranger about anything or anything. So my wife was less shy. So she was the one who did it. But I did meditation for 87 years, and I developed a confidence. But it's not the confidence, not Tim's confidence. Tim was, it's not Tim, it's the confidence from just being, from just being. So you can just be where you are. You can just do what you're doing. And Jim Nyland has spent a lot of time at the legislature. I went to the legislature with no training at all, and I, because of my Zazen, I was able just to go in. Republicans, Democrats, reactionaries, progressives. I mean, I don't want to be blasé about this. It was still kind of hard sometimes, but I was able to do it. And Linda looked at me and she said, well, you couldn't even go ask the neighbor for milk. So we discover and manifest an abundance in our hearts and minds from mindfulness. We can be okay wherever we are. But it takes practice, repetition. I hate to say drill because that sounds sort of, let's forget that, because drill sounds Army Sergeant-like. Repetition, repetition, repetition. That's why I say turtle practice, because a turtle is not drilling. A turtle is just taking a step, just feeling the earth, just being where he is. So I taught journaling, and I had never journaled. But the month before, now Ted, I know Ted has journaled for years and years. I had never done it. So the month before I was to teach it, I journaled every morning. I followed the instructions. I followed Norm's instructions for a month ahead of time. And here are the instructions. Journaling is a different kind of access that we can find than that we can find through ordinary thinking or analysis. We just write what's going on right now. We just pay attention to our senses without thinking, without trying to fix anything. We just discover rather than rehearse. And so I tell people to put their pen down and see where their pen leads them. See where it leads them. And if their pen just stops, that's okay. Just let the pen stop. And if they say, I have nothing to write, then just write, I have nothing to write. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. And to write fast. And this reveals stuff in our unconscious thoughts and internal dialogue that may ordinarily be hidden, so that we can just let it out into the light. Be mindful of it. Not be burdened of it by it anymore. Be mindful of it. And then I taught eating. Which I have taught in the past mindful eating. Now, when I first learned Zen, we ate so fast in our meals that I don't know how could anybody do mindful eating. In Tassajara, they used to time the eating. You know, they try to do it in the traditional in 18 minutes, but you know that's not the way we do it. Luckily, we're not doing it here. We're trying to be mindful, trying to just appreciate each bite. And here we are, holidays coming up, right? Craziness and stress and extra food all over the place and trying to deal with our stress. So here are the tips that I gave folks. Six tips. Let your body catch up to your brain. Let your body catch up to your brain. Instead of even eating rapidly, past full, pay attention to your body's signals. Slow down. Slow down. The body sends its satiation signal 20 minutes after the brain. Huh. Can we wait 20 minutes? It's hard to wait 20 minutes, isn't it? Especially when you're stressed out or anxious or exhausted. And so we unconsciously overeat. But we need to give our body a chance to catch up to our body to catch up, because our mind's way ahead. And here are the signals that our body sends to eat the right amount. So how do we do this? We sit down to eat whenever possible instead of standing. We chew each bite. We follow Gandhi's teaching, which is you should, what did he say? You should chew each liquid and drink each solid and chew each liquid. But that, you know, if you're really going to drink a solid, you're going to have to really be with it. If you're going to have to chew a liquid, you're going to be really with it. So we have rituals that we grew up with. Yeah, maybe you guys didn't, but in the previous generation, my generation, we grew up with these rituals. Saying grace at the beginning of dinner. We didn't have iPhones. We didn't have texting. No one was allowed to interrupt at the dinner table in my family. We couldn't talk with our mouths full. That stuff sounds all kind of silly. But in a way, it's a way of helping everybody's present at the table, be present together, be mindful together. If we think of those rules, they seem stupid. But if there are attempts to be mindful, to be present, oh, they're quite wonderful, aren't they? Number two, learn your body's hunger signals. Are you responding to an emotional need or to your body's needs? Are you sad? Are you stressed out or frustrated? Are you lonely? Are you bored? Is that where you're going for the chocolate chips or whatever you go for? Well, don't punish yourself. Just notice that. Take a breath, and if you need to have a few chocolate chips, have a few chocolate chips. This is not an abstinence approach. This is a mindfulness approach. Ask, is your stomach growling? Is your energy low? Are you feeling a little lightheaded? Learn what your body's hunger signals are and what your emotional triggers are for eating. Number three, develop healthy eating environments. Sitting down, as I said, putting food on a plate or a bowl. I'm reminding myself now, since I've been teaching this whenever I'm in the kitchen. Sit down, put your food. I like to snack in a plate or a bowl, mindfully. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. A lot of time I forget. That's okay. Not eating stuff out of the container. Some of the men in our family, I won't name them, like to eat food out of the container. There aren't too many of us. But it's a mindfulness practice. Don't eat it out of the container. Open it, put it in a plate. Use utensils. Eat with others. And enjoy food and conversation. Sometimes no conversation. In our retreats, no conversation, just eating. But at home, conversation. And limit eating to the kitchen and the dining room. Not in front of the computer. Used to be in front of the TV set. Now it's not in front of the iPhone. Not while you're texting. And if you do that stuff a little bit, it's okay. This isn't about self-punishment and being good, this is just about being open so we can be more present and enjoy our lives more. That's what it's about. So instead of eating foods that are emotionally comforting, eating foods that are healthy. I mean, practice a greater variety of foods. Notice when we're starting to binge on comfort foods. That was number four, by the way, in case you're counting. Number five, consider the life cycle of your food. Where does your food come from? Think of all the people involved in the meal. Who taught me this the first? Years ago. Maybe Thich Nhat Hanh, years ago. All the people involved in the meal, who prepared it, who stocked the shelves, who planted and harvested the raw ingredients, who supported them. Number six, just eating versus distracted eating. That means notice we're multitasking. Notice when we're so distracted that we eat something before it. Even know. So for about seven years I had Lyme's disease. And I couldn't eat popcorn in the movie theater. I was trying to get better. Couldn't eat much of anything, but won't get into that. I couldn't eat popcorn in the movie theater. Well, now the Lyme's disease has been gone for a year, so sometimes when I go to the movie theater, I like to get a really big thing of popcorn, really big, especially if no one's there to monitor my behavior. No family member. But when I get this really big popcorn, by the end of the coming attractions, the last couple of times, it's been gone. What happened to it? Where did it go? It was huge. It was huge. And yet it's gone. We call that mindless eating. Mindless. So you don't have to shame. You just notice, oh, that's gone. Oh, well, I guess I wasn't doing mindful eating. Well, I didn't even notice it was gone. Well, I love those coming attractions. That was why. They were scary, and they called for more popcorn. So eating, mindful eating. Mindful conversation. We spent time doing mindful conversation. So people spent time just listening to each other, just listening. I told them to be aware of their bodies and their breaths, the listeners, to paying attention to the words, the body language, the tone of voice, the intentions behind the words, and to notice their reactions to what they're hearing. Whether they're anxious when they hear something, whether they're defensive, whether they're spacing out, so that they can course correct. And then the speaker, maintaining awareness of his or her body and breath, and speaking with honesty and kindness, and noticing his or her default ways of responding, and reorienting herself. And afterwards, when I asked for feedback, the hardest thing for them was, number one, the listeners wanted to give advice. And that was the male listeners. The female listeners didn't want to give advice, but they wanted to fix the situation. They wanted to help the person. But, and this is a sample of like three and three, you know, so we can't publish anything. Wonderful. How much time in our lives do we spend having conversations with people? Can we really be there with each other? Really listen in our hearts and our minds? And then really, really reflect back what we heard and how we feel? Wonderful mindfulness practice. So in Zen, we have something called Dokusan. And those of you who've been around for a while know what that means. And in Japan, Dokusan generally last in Soto Zen monasteries 4 to 6 minutes. I'm kind of making this up, but they're very, very short. And Suzuki, my teacher's Dokusans with me were very short. I think I had one that lasted 8 or 9 minutes once. But here in America, as we develop our Zen, our mindfulness, mindful conversation is a key part of what I do here and what we all do here. Most of us who are teachers here have people who come to see us regularly. who are practicing. And we sit with them and listen to them with our hearts and our minds for 6 minutes, 8 minutes, 40 minutes, 45 minutes, 50 minutes. And they in turn respond back and forth, back and forth. Mindful conversation. So I think in American Zen, mindful conversation is not just going to be the 6 minute Doksan. It's already developing into something quite wonderful and quite deep, where we really share in a heartfelt way what's going on with each other, so that we can touch a core of stillness that's always here. But our culture is different than Japanese culture. Our culture focuses on self-disclosing. Theirs not so much. Ours focuses on giving feedback. Theirs not at all. Very impolite. Very rude. Then I also talked in my workshop, which some of you were at, about some of the brain science stuff that I've talked about before. Neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, and which is in one of my book that's coming out in June. Neuroplasticity. So we start with a brain that's just nice and soft, the texture of Play-Doh, and that brain creates paths in support of specific habits, and it hardens around those paths, those habitual paths. And as we engage in the habit over and over again, it gets harder and harder, and the brain gets denser and denser. So the nice soft Play-Doh turns into something really, really dense. But through those little habits, we get a surge of pleasure and confidence. The problem is it locks into those habits, and so it's lost its plasticity. So mindfulness is what? About seeing that so we can recover our natural plasticity. And there's been work on this, meditators and non-meditators, but I won't get into that. I guess we're pretty plastic, if you believe the science. So our plasticity is marred in two ways. One, by our external habits, particularly our addictive habits, that those habits that we do over and over again to give us some feeling of relief or pleasure or even confidence. It hardens around those, and it also hardens around our internal chattering, our internal habit of chattering. So all mindfulness is stopping the chain of reactivity by noticing that not only now I can have popcorn, but I can also drink coffee, and I can eat, I can have chocolate. So I go walking every day. So I walk different in the neighborhood around here. If in case you didn't know, there are two Dunn brothers around here. There is one Caribou Coffee around here, and there are several other places where they have mocha. And mocha is my thing, because mocha, chocolate and coffee together? Can you imagine that? I don't mind hardening my brain for a rush of mocha 6 times a day. But I can notice when I go by this Dunbar. I have a circuit I go, although I change it all the time, and I go by all three of those places. I just notice, there it is. If I'm thinking, I want to go in, what's going on with me? Am I feeling tired? Am I feeling needy? Just be there with it. Sometimes I go in, and sometimes I don't go in. and it's fine. But this, again, is not about being good or bad. This is about paying attention. Paying attention so we can be more open. And it's about ultimately disidentifying with all the internal addiction to their chatter. So that's brain plasticity. Now, mirror neurons, which I talked about before too, repeated tests starting with monkeys and then moving on to human beings show that an observed action in another person can signal the same brain response as a first-hand physical reaction. A monkey who was observing another monkey eating a banana, the observing monkey, his premotor cells went wild, suggesting that he was getting ready to grab a banana. And then when the other one started eating the banana, the observer's brain cells actually mimic the other person's. Mimic the other monkeys. Monkey person. So then they started doing this with humans. Oh, the same deal. Mirror neurons. And what's bare awareness all about? What's mindfulness all about? But the possibility that we can experience these mirror neurons. So, let's see. Is Andrea Grant here today? I don't see Andrea Grant.
She's in the kitchen.
Andrea, are you here? She's in the kitchen. Okay. What about? Well, I don't know. So we had a pre-ordination on Friday night. And is Matt here someplace?
No.
Oh,
he's going to be with his dad.
I see. So Ted ordained Matt on Friday night. It was a beautiful ceremony, and out in the kitchen there was a wonderful spread that was prepared by, I don't know who did what, Andrea Grant, Dale, is Dale here? Oh, Dale's here, and Dave Walter. So since Dave Walter's in charge, and I thought he was the guy, I thanked him. So I said, thank you, Dave. And Dave said, oh, well, you're welcome, but it was really Dale and Andrea who did it all. So I acknowledge that you, Dale, did something for me. I'm the guiding teacher. It's just wonderful that I just get to show up. Well, that you did that for me. I mean, you may not have, you were really doing it for the whole community, but in a way you did it for me. Because I got here and everything was taken care of and everything. And so I thanked you. I thanked you for sharing a resource. And then you tell me I'm welcome. You say you're welcome, Tim. As Dave said, with this disclaimer that he had done anything, but Dave is always disclaiming. And he's saying to me, you're welcome into my group, Tim. You're welcome into my group to share my resources and relationships. That's what your welcome means. So when I'm welcomed by Dave, I feel safe, less afraid. Protected from a predator is what is biologically what we're talking about. Historically, protected from a predator. My sense of safety is then mirrored in Dale. So when two people can share their resources and relationships, both are stronger. Any two people. And imagine what would be like on a national level, on an international level, on a global level. And the key is bare awareness. So we have the ability to relax into many possibilities and many feelings and be open to all kinds of environmental stimuli. The more our nervous system, not so much Tim, because Tim has to get out of the way, recognizes this perspective of interdependence beyond the limitations of time and space, the more it relaxes, and the more new expansive areas of the brain begin to thrive, and neurons multiply according to how often they are fired. The more often we walk new pathways of the brain, the more easily these pathways open. The more we practice mindfulness, the more mirror neurons we have at our disposal, and the easier it is to disentangle and access the deeper within, the deeper beyond. So, putting too much energy into addictive, repetitive, habitual behaviors and our internal chatter, it means that we're neglecting or repressing our mirror neuron activity. The good news is that we can stop doing that right now. That takes practice. We maybe can only stop doing it for this now, and then the next now we can't, but that's okay. We just keep doing it. It takes practice. Never too late. And when that happens, we fall into a natural sense of camaraderie that's not obscured. Instead of saying, it's my happiness that Dale did this beautiful spread, or it's his happiness, it's happiness of the room, of the Sangha, of us all being together. And then there's another interesting thing about mirror neurons, is that we can have empathy for another form because of mirror neurons. We can also have empathy for our own form, our own inner form. So when a mirror neuron sparks empathy for its own process, a mirror neuron's awareness turns to the other mirror neurons inside, and the brain becomes aware that it is aware. What is this? This is self-compassion. This is self-love. Very important. The scriptures don't mention this. I don't know why. I want to go back and talk to all those guys who wrote the scriptures and say, why did you guys leave this stuff out? It's crucial. Crucial. More important, I think. Well, in the way they mention it, Huayan mentions it, like a tunnel of mirrors into infinity. Mirror neuron activity, although they don't talk about mirror neurons in the 8th century in China. But here's, I think one of you guys quoted from this recently in a talk, maybe Wanda. To illustrate mirror neuron activity, and I'm making this up because in the 8th century they didn't know anything about neuron activity, mirror neuron activity scientifically, but to emphasize the teaching of Huayan, Fa Zhang met with Empress Wu, and he called for a candle and placed it surrounded by mirrors on every side. When lit, the candle was reflected in each mirror and each of the reflections in every other mirror, so that in any one mirror were the images of all the others. Neuron activities. A tunnel of mirrors into infinity. Wow! Wow! So, immediate psychological effect on everyone. Generations, forward and backward. Without us moving a muscle or saying a word. Isn't that cool? Isn't that cool? And it's never too late. We think the brain is so hard, but just a little bit of mindfulness practice and it begins to soften. It begins to soften. So finally, I want to talk about a progression, mindfulness progression, which I think I made up, but I'm not sure. People always ask me where I got things. I don't even know. I think I made this one up, though. So there's a progression from, we begin, they're up there in their intro up there now, and they're thinking, What am I going to get from meditation, right? What am I going to get from mindfulness? What am I going to get from meditation? That's natural. You wouldn't come here in the first place if you didn't think that, right? Progression from that to what can I learn about myself? Progression from that, oh, it's in the program there, to what can I discover about my relationships? And a progression from that to living wakefully from our still centers, which is the still center of all life. So I'm giving a fictionalized account of a guy I used to work with here at Zen Center. I'm going to call him Jerome, and he was a supervisor at work. He had a lot of staff under him. This was a competitive corporate environment. small business corporate environment, and he was micromanaging all his staff. He was obsessed with hitting his quarterly targets and making his budget work. He was pushing his staff. He resented his boss, felt his boss was always on his case. He feared he was going to get fired or maybe just get burned out and have to quit. So I hear this story so often in the corporate world. Oh, a little, some in the not-for-profit world, too. And his workaholic ethic had gotten him to the position of being a supervisor. But it wasn't working anymore. As a matter of fact, his staff were just kind of running away from him and hiding and not sharing stuff with him. So he came and started doing meditation here and meeting with me one-to-one. And after the first year or so, I don't know, he complained to me that he hadn't gotten much out of his meditation. He said at first he did. But not anymore. He wasn't getting much out of his meditation. And I said, but you haven't gotten much out of it, but you told me that you've seen this fear-based thinking that you never really realized you had. You've noticed all these judgments. You've noticed the beliefs that hold these judgments up. And you've told me that you're more aware of your anxiety, that you can really, really feel it in your chest now, what you didn't used to. And you've noticed how that relates to your harsh standards at work and unrealistic demands you make on yourself and others. So he said, oh, yeah. Well, what did he expect? He expected, I mean, that's wonderful. That's mindfulness. He didn't have much relief. And often if you're meditation, we don't get relief in our meditation because we see our patterns, our habits, in a way we haven't seen them. And we see how they stress us out. The repression of them abates, and they're just here. But that's wonderful. That's a movement from what can I get from this to what can I discover about myself. And he discovered a lot about himself. And if you don't discover stuff about yourself, how can you ever change? How can you ever change? So then, I worked with him for a while more, maybe another year or two, and he began to move to discovering stuff about his relationships with his staff and his spouse, and saw how he was putting himself down and putting them down, and the more he needed to put them down, the more he put himself down, and how it went on ad infinitum, and he was able to reach out to them and stop himself when his impulse was to jump in and control and be more supportive. As he got better at doing this, his stress dropped, and everybody in the group's stress dropped. Mirror neurons. His direct reports trusted him more and did better work. He began to listen to them. They began to listen to him. He began to be a little bit of empathic. They, in turn, reflected with their own empathy with their mirror neurons. So they began to see each other as allies. Now, the boss up there was still the enemy. Huh? Too bad. Maybe they hadn't really progressed yet, but they progressed. You know, it takes a little bit of time to move all the way out. It takes a lot of time. So he built trust by talking of his own fears and vulnerabilities more openly. And spoke from his heart more, which inspired his team. So the result is, back to the beginning of my talk, more emotional intelligence. More emotional intelligence, which means more joy, more intimacy, more life, more love. And then the last one, I don't know if he did the last one, he dropped away from Zen Center. You know, lots of people that I've worked with over the years stay here for 2 or 3 or 4 years and then they go, and I don't know what happens to them. I feel sad about that, but it just happens. It's been happening ever since I started coming. So, anyway, so I don't know if he moved from what can I discover about my relationships to living wakefully from his still center, which is the still center of all of us. I don't know. But that is the next step in the progression. Now, don't get too linear about this and start measuring where you are, because then I'm going to deny that I said this entirely. Because then your neuroplasticity will get hard because from measuring. So, that's what mindfulness is about, learning to ultimately just live wakefully and experience the still center that's here. It's always here within all beings, so that we can meet at that center, at that point of stillness, over and over. And even if we don't think we're meeting, just sitting and engaging in zazen together, mindful conversation together, doing work together, we're generating that sense of empathy that opens up to this still camaraderie with everyone and everything. So, as Bodhidharma says, we can get this practice in our skin, flesh, bone, and marrow. So that's the way that this practice was kind of passed on to me by Katagiri Roshi and Suzuki Roshi. They both said they passed it on warm hand, warm hand. I like that. Warm hand, warm hand. Warm heart to warm heart. Warm mirror neuron to more warm mirror neuron, if you want to be a scientist. I never used to want to be a scientist till I found all this cool stuff that validated how I spent the last 50 years and explained it all. I thought, oh, cool. So I think that's what I want to say for today. That summarizes. Now you don't have to spend $175 to do the St. Thomas thing. You got the deal. But you should donate an extra to the Donna Ball this morning. Thank you. I forgot. Questions. Questions, comments? Anybody? Questions, comments?
Tim.
Yeah.
I attended that event at St. Thomas. And I thought it was remarkable. A lot of the people there were really new to these practices.
Yeah.
And by the end of the day, that room seemed so quiet and so calm. It was really wonderful. And
it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't want to overstate it, but I think there is some progression from mindfulness. That's something I need that I want to get to just kind of living from your still center, as you said.
Uh-huh.
And so I think these practices are really effective. And something that's great about mindfulness practice is some of it is something you sort of add to your schedule, like journaling or something, but a lot of it is just doing stuff that you're doing anyway.
That's right.
You just do it in a different way.
You
walk every day, you eat every day.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. What else?
Tim?
Yeah.
A few weeks ago on Science Friday, they interviewed the author of a book. I think the title was Bored and Brilliant.
Bored and Brilliant.
Yeah, and it was about how being bored puts you in a state of mind that is much more conducive to being creative. And that we don't get enough of that in our society. And I think that might be one of the things I've gotten from my practice. But I have gotten much more tolerant of being bored.
Uh-huh.
I go someplace and I have to wait a while. Just wait. Uh-huh. It's much more tolerable now.
Ah, cool. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. Yeah, we don't think about, we don't want to think about boredom when we think of meditation, but just come do a retreat. You'll get, either you'll run out of here or you'll get to be pretty intimate with boredom. I'm pretty accepting of it, pretty accepting. Did I see another hand around here? Anybody else?
Well, just to add to what Nico said, I studied with Trungpa for a while, and he teaches hot boredom going into cool boredom.
Ah, hot boredom going into cold boredom. Do you want to elaborate on that, Robert?
Well, when you first start out, boredom is hot boredom.
Ah.
It's hard to tolerate.
Yeah.
You want to get out of there.
Yeah.
But eventually, from sitting for a long time, then it starts turning into cool boredom.
Good, I like that.
The feeling of trying to get away.
The feeling of what?
The feeling of agitation and trying to get out of it. Stops being. So that's cool.
Yeah. Good. Good. Could you guys hear him? Okay. Who else? Yeah.
Okay, I just didn't expect to bring this cartoon up that I heard about, but somehow I think it fits in with this subject. On NPR, I heard an interview with a Cuban political social commentator cartoonist. This cartoonist liked to draw pictures. He lives in Mexico now, but he came from Cuba during the revolution, and he likes to do cartoons that make comments on the human condition without any words, no dialogue, no caption. And in one cartoon that they described, there's a couple park benches with a couple park couples. There's a couple on each. And one couple is an older couple, not so good looking anymore, aged. And they are passionately making out in public, sitting on a park bench. They're really into each other. And they're in that moment with each other on the park bench. Next to them, in another bench, is a beautiful young couple. And they're focused on their phones that they're holding in their laps.
About the whole thing.
I felt that that fit in really well with what these gentlemen just said. The young couple aren't even looking up out of their phones or at each other or anything else.
So when I did the workshop, I said to someone the day before, well, I'm going to ask them to check their cell phones at the door. Yeah, at the door and just put them in a pile. And my couple of my advice, you can't do that. You can't do that. So I didn't do it.
Well, the older couple had the awareness to experience each other and the moment and where they were. The younger couple just wanted to be distracted.
Thank you. Yeah, I get that. So I wanted them to leave them at the door. But I was told, no, that's not okay. They'll be really mad and it'll wreck their day. So I didn't. I said, please keep them off. And if you need to use them at a break, then go out and use them. Then I did a mini version of this same workshop at an architectural firm in St. Paul last week. And for about 60 people, a big architectural firm. Well, I pulled my iPhone out. And I put it next to my talk. And I really just put it there so I could pay attention to the time because I don't wear a watch. But I forgot to turn it off. And right after I talked to them about technology and how distracted we are by technology and how we really have to just come back to being present, my phone rang. Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Actually, it's wonderful. Any opportunity to tell a joke or... Yeah, Carrie.
I imagine that the people at these events were adults.
Yeah, they were adults.
Yeah. Well, because I'm thinking about children. I work with teens, 6th grade through 12th grade, and I teach yoga to them. So through yoga, we practice mindfulness, body mindfulness of breath. And what I'm noticing... for the young people in our society is that, you know, it is so hard. There's so much more taking their attention away, like you're talking about, right? Two young people sitting on a bench watching their phones. And Could you see yourself bringing this to teens and preteens in a way that they would be able to receive?
Well, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? It'd be nice, yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know. My grandkids are already, you know, my 11-year-old is already, he's got something called a shift or something, I don't know what it is, but that he saved his allowance. It costs $300 and he has it with him almost all the time. So I don't know. But there have been challenges in every generation, and every generation has thought, oh, this younger generation, they're all attention deficit disorder and they're all lazy, and they, you know, so yeah. But I think we have to, I mean, I think it's wonderful you're doing that, and I think we just have to work one person at a time and just feel our way along. I mean, they're developing some the problem is that my 11-year-old boy, that's his behaviors are so habituated already, and actually he's sneaky about it. His mother doesn't believe he's sneaky, but I can see that he's sneaky. So, you know, but I can remember being sneaky myself at 11 and 12 about other things. I won't get into those right now. And, you know, I'm okay. So. Other people?
Could I add something?
Sure.
So Zen Center, we do have a program for middle school and high school students, which we cooperate with Clouds and Water Zen Center in St. Paul on that. And the meetings take place over there. But there is a great deal of, you know, teaching of mindfulness and meditation to kids in that age group. And it works really well. I'm going over there today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay. And do you allow them to bring their electronic equipment into the room?
No, we don't.
Yeah.
Just to say something more about what Ted said, there's actually a youth group in Blaine of Buddhist mindfulness practitioners.
Oh, wonderful. In Blaine?
In Blaine, yeah.
Just spontaneous, or?
Sort of. They're associated with a Vietnamese temple.
Oh, cool. Cool, yeah. Yeah, well, so that is something good that's happened. I mean, at the same time that there's all this habituation toward technology, my 11-year-old grandson has already heard the term mindfulness. I mean, he's heard, I don't know what the French word, he's primarily French-speaking, but they had a little deal on mindfulness in his class in Paris. And, you know, when I was, you know, I wish my father were still alive. Because my father thought I was just totally out to lunch. Now he could read about what I'm doing in Time magazine. I'm trying to bring him back. So that's wonderful, don't you think? Okay, thanks a lot, and on to Jim.